This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
It's time once again for Time Magazine. Each week, we bring you stories created by a team of national correspondents, from entertainment to politics, from technology to economics. Time Magazine has it all. Coming up on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Time Magazine, and I'm your reader, Stacy Stamus, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from November 10th, copyright 2025, Time USA, LLC. The cover of this week's Time magazine is a picture of Donald Trump sitting at his desk in the Oval Office. He is shown from the waist down wearing a suit. The undershirt is white, the jacket is dark blue, and he wears a plain red tie. His elbows rest on his dark brown desk, which lines the bottom of the photo. His right hand is balled into a fist, and his left hand is clasped over it. Trump rests his chin on his hands. His expression is that of a frown with furrowed brows and squinting eyes. Behind him are four large flags. From the viewer's left to right, they are the Marine Corps flag, the United States flag, the flag of the President, and the U.S. Navy flag. The Marine Corps flag is red with a wavy white banner on the bottom with the branch's name. In the center, there is a globe of the world where all the continents are yellow in color. The U.S. flag is made up of horizontal red and white stripes and a blue square in the upper left that contains 50 white stars. The flag of the president is dark blue. An eagle rests in the center, wings and legs splayed out, and red and white stripes going down its body. 50 white stars surround it in a circle. The Navy flag also contains an eagle with spread wings. It stands on a metal anchor with a large wooden ship in the background that has many white masts. There are also many framed pictures on a long table behind Trump, with details that are too blurred to make out. And directly above and behind Trump is a large window. Large white text at the top of the photo reads, "Trump's World." This photo is associated with the article, "How the Deal Got Done," by Eric Cortaleza. And now I'll begin with How the Deal Got Done, Inside Trump's Unconventional Middle East Diplomacy, by Eric Cortaleza. On the evening of Saturday, October 4th, Donald Trump called Benjamin Netanyahu to deliver a message. The war in Gaza was over. Trump's envoys had brokered a deal with mediators from Qatar, Egypt, and Turkey to end 2 years of bombardment and bloodshed. The following Monday, the president told Netanyahu they were going to announce the agreement, and the Israeli premier had to accept it. "Bibi, you can't fight the world," Trump told him, recounting their conversation in an interview with Time. "You can fight individual battles, but the world's against you." Netanyahu pushed back, but Trump wasn't having it. He launched into a profanity-laced monologue cataloging all he'd done for Israel as president, moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, recognizing its sovereignty over the Golan Heights, brokering the Abraham Accords that normalized relations between Israel and several Arab states, even joining Israel's strikes on Iran in June. Trump could no longer stand with Netanyahu, he suggested, if the prime minister didn't sign on to the pact. "It was a very blunt and straightforward statement to Bibi," says Steve Witkoff, Trump's special envoy to the Middle East, "that he had no tolerance for anything other than this." Netanyahu's office declined to comment. By the end of the call, Netanyahu had agreed to a two-phase deal that included a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, secured the return of Israeli hostages in exchange for Palestinian prisoners and detainees, allowed aid shipments into the ravaged enclave, withdrew Israeli forces from parts of the Gaza Strip, and opened negotiations for a final settlement. If it holds, the accord would end the longest war in Israel's history, one that killed some 2,000 Israelis and nearly 70,000 Palestinians. The deal marks a milestone in Trump's ongoing bid to reshape the modern Middle East. During the past 9 months, the president has attacked Iran's nuclear infrastructure and helped degrade its standing in the region. Isolating Tehran hastened the fall of the Assad regime in Syria, and new governments in Damascus and Beirut have signaled a desire to restore ties with Washington. He has bombed Houthi targets in Yemen, leading to an agreement that the rebel group would no longer target U.S. vessels in the Red Sea. Now he has used a real estate dealmaker's sensibility, an instinct for leverage, for cajoling counterparts through flattery and the threat of force to push a peace deal on Hamas and Netanyahu, two seemingly intractable enemies. The U.S. president is breaking all the long-held assumptions of Middle East diplomacy, says Michael Oren, the historian and former Israeli ambassador to the U.S. Trump is coming back and saying, "We're going to reestablish America's hedge money here," and he's done it so far. Trump traces his achievements so far to his willingness to use America's military might. Through the assassination of the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani in his first term and his decision to strike three Iranian nuclear facilities last spring, Trump earned enough goodwill among the Israeli public and stirred enough fear among the nation's adversaries to bring both parties to the bargaining table. "It would have been impossible to make a deal like this before," Trump says of his attacks on Iran. "No president was willing to do it, and I was willing to do it, and by doing it, we had a different Middle East." Of course, the ceasefire remains fragile, and the deal could still unravel. Hamas has yet to return the remains of all the deceased Israeli hostages, prompting Israel to close the Rafah crossing and restrict aid. Videos on social media show Hamas gunmen executing rivals in the streets. On October 19th, Israel accused the militant group of violating the ceasefire after attacks on Israeli soldiers. In the span of a week, the situation grew precarious enough that Trump dispatched Vice President J.D. Vance to the region in a bid to hold the agreement together. The next phase is even thornier. It includes defining the scope of Israel's military withdrawal and the structure of a peacekeeping force, disarming Hamas, and determining who will govern post-war Gaza. "Those are very difficult things to do," says Dan Shapiro, the former U.S. ambassador to Israel under Barack Obama. Among the risks, Shapiro says, is that Trump could end up with a kind of frozen conflict in the current situation, with Israel controlling half of Gaza, Hamas controlling the other half, suppressing its own people, and no real reconstruction. For those reasons, experts fear the peace may prove fleeting, but Trump's foreign policy has also defied the predictions of his critics. His America First creed, once synonymous with isolationism and retreat, has evolved into an unconventional form of personalized diplomacy unburdened by doctrine. While he has shown himself content to let Russia have greater dominance over Europe and China, exert its will in the Indo-Pacific region, he has asserted U.S. power in the Middle East in surprising ways. Trump has deepened Washington's ties with Riyadh, Abu Dhabi, and Doha. He expects Saudi Arabia to normalize ties with Israel and join the Abraham Accords by year's end. He tells Time he intends to visit Gaza soon, as U.S. partners hammer out a plan to reconstruct the Strip. Soon he envisions greater economic integration between Israel and its Arab neighbors. The bullish vision of what all this could mean would be transformative. Rail lines from the Mediterranean to the Persian Gulf, free trade agreements between Israel and its neighbors, the establishment of a new regional energy grid, Saudis vacationing in Tel Aviv. In Trump's telling, this regional reset would be impossible without one essential ingredient, himself. "The most important thing," he tells Time, "is they have to respect the President of the United States. The Middle East has to understand that. It's almost the presidency more than the country." Trump was en route to Charlie Kirk's funeral on September 21st when he summoned his top aides and allies to his private cabin aboard Air Force One. Gathered around the table were his chief of staff, Susie Wiles, House Speaker Mike Johnson, and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Witkoff was patched into the conversation by phone. The group had a problem to deal with. Hours earlier, Israeli warplanes had struck Hamas operatives in Doha, who were visiting a compound to discuss ceasefire negotiations. The attack violated the sovereignty of Qatar, a USAE ally and the chief mediator with Hamas. The assault enraged Trump. "That was terrible," Trump says now, calling the decision a tactical mistake on Netanyahu's part. Yet for U.S. negotiators, it also represented an opportunity. The assault was a warning to Arab leaders that the war in Gaza would not stay confined there. Trump, meanwhile, saw a chance to use outrage over the attack to coax regional leaders to the table. "This was one of the things that brought us all together," Trump says. "It was so out of joint that it sort of got everybody to do what they have to do. If you took that away, we might not be talking about this subject right now." The president's approach to the region took shape in his first term. He entered office without foreign policy experience. He handed the Middle East portfolio to Kushner, his son-in-law, and a fellow real estate developer who approached the matter less as a traditional diplomat than as a dealmaker. When Trump followed through on his campaign vow to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and move the U.S. embassy there, the Palestinians broke off contact with Washington. That rupture gave rise to a new approach to the long-standing Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Rather than accept the conventional wisdom that Israel could not integrate with the Arab world without first making peace with the Palestinians, Trump's team sought to flip the formula. They called it the outside-in strategy: build peace from the periphery inward. During the 2024 campaign, Trump was in touch with Netanyahu. The Israeli Prime Minister visited him at Mar-a-Lago that July. It was an open secret that Netanyahu was rooting for Trump's return to the White House as President Joe Biden pressured him to halt the onslaught on Gaza. But Netanyahu's relationship with Trump was fraught as well. Trump left office furious at the Israeli leader, first for withdrawing from a planned 2020 joint strike on Soleimani, a claim Israel has denied, and later for becoming one of the first world leaders to congratulate Biden on his election victory in 2020. Netanyahu was eager for a rapprochement. When time brought up Israel's attacks on Hezbollah and regime change in Syria, the president interrupted. "All of those attacks were done under my auspices, you know, with Israel doing the attacks, with the pagers and all that stuff." He was referring to Israel's covert operation in September 2024 that targeted Hezbollah's officials by detonating thousands of pagers, killing dozens and inflicting a psychological scar on the terrorist group for succumbing to such a sophisticated security breach. Biden was still in the White House and Trump was a candidate. "They let me know everything," he says, "and sometimes I'd say no, and they'd be respectful of that." A Biden representative declined to comment. A Trump spokesperson later said the president misspoke and was referring to Israel's recent strike on Doha. After Trump won in November 2024, Witkoff traveled to Washington to meet with key members of Biden's foreign policy team: National Security Council Coordinator for the Middle East, Brett McGurk; National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan; and Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. Constrained by the Logan Act's restrictions on private citizens negotiating foreign policy, Witkoff secured approval from the Biden team to hold talks with Israeli and Arab interlocutors. Even as the Biden administration continued its own diplomacy, a new sense of possibility had begun to take hold. Hamas was signaling that they wanted to gain some political capital with the Trump administration, Witkoff told me. Beyond political capital, they were afraid of him. The day before Trump's second inauguration, Israel and Hamas agreed to a ceasefire and Hamas released 33 hostages. But the fighting resumed in short order. Trying to keep talks on track, Trump had invited Netanyahu to the White House in February when he proposed relocating Gaza's population and remaking the Strip into the Riviera of the Middle East. Experts say the outlandish idea galvanized Arab negotiators and regional mediators to expedite a peace process. "The president scared the hell out of them when he came up with the Riviera idea," says Nimrod Novik, a former senior advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres and now a fellow with the Israel Policy Forum. Never mind the Riviera, but for them to host 2 million Gazans for the duration of Reconstruction or beyond was unthinkable on several grounds. The theater of conflict soon expanded. Israeli forces struck Iran's nuclear facilities in June, unnerving a White House that feared the bombing campaign would derail its efforts at diplomacy. Yet Netanyahu, through careful planning, was able to enlist Trump to join the campaign, according to a senior Israeli official who spoke on condition of anonymity because he was not authorized to discuss the conversations. At their meeting in February, Netanyahu had agreed to give Trump a 60-day window to engage in talks with the Iranians on a nuclear agreement, expecting that they would prove fruitless, according to an Israeli official familiar with the matter. When they produced no resolution, Netanyahu launched the attack. At first, a White House official says Trump was frustrated. The offensive jeopardized the administration's hopes of a nuclear deal with Tehran. But Trump warmed to the idea of joining the strike, seeing their impact and concurring with Netanyahu's assessment that the Iranians were trying to manipulate him. On June 22nd, Trump unleashed U.S. bunker buster bombs that crippled Iran's nuclear infrastructure, according to U.S. and Israeli officials. Then Netanyahu targeted Hamas leaders in Doha. The assault provoked a crisis that Kushner and Witkoff were determined not to waste. "We had an opening," Kushner says. "It's just an element of how the president thinks." The pair worked the UN General Assembly circuit, hashing out a 20-point plan with Qatari mediators, Egyptian and Turkish interlocutors, and Israeli officials. The proposal called for an immediate ceasefire and hostage exchange, Israeli security guarantees, the demilitarization of Gaza, and a new civilian governing authority. When the document reached the president, he scheduled a meeting with the leader of Arab states in a large room at the UN on Rosh Hashanah. Joined by Witkoff, Wiles, and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Trump began the session, U.S. officials say, with a long soliloquy about ending the killing and achieving a lasting peace, the goal that has eluded statesmen since the founding of Israel. Then he went around the table, soliciting each leader's counsel. Prince Faisal, representing the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and King Abdullah of Jordan voiced support for the framework. The negotiations picked up steam from there. Regional leaders, including the Turks and Qataris, helped lean on Hamas. Turkey, a member of NATO, provided a boost by offering Hamas political leaders protection from Israeli strikes if they came to the table, says Soner Kagapte, a Turkish scholar at the Washington Institute for the Near East Policy. "Turkey has quite a bit of sway over Hamas political wing," he says, "and I think Ankara used that influence." Trump applied pressure too, warning that if the militant group refused to disarm or attempted to subvert the deal, it would face complete obliteration. The demand was clear, the return of every Israeli captive, no longer in stages. "I said, no more of that. You're giving us the effing hostages, all of them," Trump says. The threat drew credibility from the recent strikes on Iran. "The real clincher was Trump's willingness to use military force," says Oren. "The previous Democratic administrations were very averse to using military force. They preferred soft power. Soft power is not widely respected in the Middle East." Trump's popularity in Israel, where his approval ratings dwarfed the Israeli premier's, gave him leverage over Netanyahu. He knew to embrace Netanyahu in public while pressuring him in private to halt the fighting, aides says. "He would have just kept going," Trump tells Time. "It could have gone on for years. It would have gone on for years. But I stopped him, and everybody came together when I stopped him." That much may be true, but Israelis and Palestinians alike understand that the success of Phase 2 will depend on Trump's willingness to stay engaged, on his leverage with Netanyahu, and his influence over the region's key players. If the guarantors of this process want it to succeed, it will succeed, particularly the Trump administration, says Khaled El-Gindi, a former Palestinian Authority negotiator. But there are also ways, he adds, that the pact could crumble. One question is the extent to which an international peacekeeping force will allow the Palestinians to choose their own future governance. Israelis and other Arab powers insist Hamas cannot play a role, but the Islamist group, which the U.S. classifies as a terrorist organization, is not going to negate it itself as a political movement, El-Gindi says. I don't think folks in Israel are open to any kind of Hamas participation in anything going forward, and that even if Hamas consents to a technocratic government, they will see that as illegitimate. Trump himself may care little about the specifics of Gaza's post-war order so long as he can claim credit as a peacemaker. But it is difficult to negotiate when there is no unified Palestinian leadership, a dynamic Netanyahu spent decades cultivating by keeping Hamas in Gaza and the Fatah-led Palestinian Authority in the West Bank divided. They don't have a leader right now, Trump tells me, at least a visible leader, and they don't really want to because every one of those leaders has been shot. It's not a hot job. Trump says he likes Mahmoud Abbas, the aging head of the Palestinian Authority, but suggests it's unlikely he would be the right person to lead post-war Gaza. One option is calling on Israel to release Marwan Barghouti, the imprisoned Fatah leader who has spent more than two decades behind bars for allegedly directing the murder of four Israelis and one Greek Orthodox monk during the Second Intifada. I was literally being confronted with that question about 15 minutes before you called, Trump says, so I'll be making a decision. Many regional observers believe Barghouti is the only figure capable of uniting the Palestinians. Polls show him as a leading candidate in a hypothetical election for president of the Palestinian Authority. Netanyahu, meanwhile, faces rebellion from white right-wing ministers who want to block a path to Palestinian statehood and annex the West Bank. Trump warns such a move would meet fierce U.S. resistance. It won't happen because I gave my word to the Arab countries, he told me. Israel would lose all of its support from the United States if that happened. Already, he has had to enforce the deal's terms, sending Vance to Israel to ensure that neither Netanyahu nor Hamas allow the agreement to unravel. Netanyahu briefly halted the humanitarian aid to Gaza, citing Hamas' failure to return the bodies it had promised and its attacks on Israeli targets, while Vance, Kushner, and Witkoff pressed ahead with reconstruction talks to sustain momentum. In the meantime, Trump's gaze has shifted beyond Gaza. He wants to expand the Abraham Accords, most dramatically through normalization between Israel and Saudi Arabia. The Saudis have placed two conditions on the table: an end to the fighting and a credible path toward Palestinian sovereignty, even if not necessarily full statehood. Trump believes both are within reach. I think Saudi Arabia is going to lead the way, he says. We don't have the Iran threat anymore. We don't have any threats anymore. We have peace in the Middle East. Peace in the Middle East is, of course, a florid exaggeration. Yet Trump has achieved a ceasefire that returned the last living hostages to Israel and, for a moment at least, opened the door to a new chapter in the region. Israel was so intent on the hostages, I was actually surprised, Trump says. You would have thought they would have sacrificed the hostages in order to keep going, right? The people of Israel wanted the hostages more than they wanted anything else, and we got the hostages. The question now is not only whether the fragile architecture of the deal will hold, it's whether Trump can sustain the kind of focus required to turn a momentary reprieve in the fighting into something lasting. It would require the kind of obsessive focus that Jimmy Carter brought to Camp David. Long nights, endless details, a diplomacy of sheer endurance. When I ask whether the new regional dynamics can outlast him, Trump doesn't hesitate. While I'm there, it's only going to get better and stronger, and it's going to be perfect, he says. What happens after me? I can't tell you that. Moving on to The View. Machine Loving by Maisha Battle. Many modern relationships start with a phone notification, a text from the stranger from last night, a delightful chime that you're a match, a haptic vibrating your hand. Daters are using ChatGPT and Claude to craft their profiles and witty messages. People are even skipping human dating altogether in favor of AI. It's fair to say our romantic relationships are becoming dependent on our use of technology. The term digisexual was coined in 2017 to identify those whose primary sexual experiences are mediated by technology, meaning they prefer tech-based sex as opposed to flesh-based sex. By that definition, there's a growing number of digisexuals out in the dating scene. According to a 2023 Pew Research Center report, 30% of U.S. adults and 53% under the age of 30 have used a dating site or app. Increasingly, only 10% of partnered people polled met in this way. That means that many daters who use apps are engaging with this technology without seeing the results that they signed up for. Of course, not everyone wants a relationship, but according to surveys conducted by Tinder, the most used dating app in the country, the majority of daters do. As a result, many daters are frustrated by their relationships with the apps. In fact, those relationships are often the only ones they get from dating online. Another phenomenon I'm seeing more and more often is people who would rather text, video call, and engage with their matches through social media than ever meet in person. Only after weeks, months, or sometimes over a year of tech-based communication will some of my clients realize they should meet their connection in person. Technological encroachment on your love life doesn't end with dating. We use technology to keep in touch, plan dates, send romantic missives, and sext. There are apps designed to help you build a bond by asking you and your partner about yourselves, then sharing your responses. Some apps help you learn the best ways to please yourself and your partner in bed, while others promise deeper conversations through helpful prompts. There are apps for chore wheels, therapy, mindfulness, relationship coaching, and pretty much anything else you need help with. We even use tech as a way to judge compatibility. I've had clients who really struggled with how the person they were dating communicated with them digitally. In fact, it's a common complaint that face-to-face interactions are great, but the person's texting style or pace of communicating digitally is less than ideal. In some cases, this mismatch was enough for the relationship to end. In others, it was cause for conversations and either a compromise or acceptance. And then there's technology we use for our intimate lives. Sending nudes that disappear is an option on several messaging apps. And if you want to know what you and your partner have in common sexually, there's an app for that too. A quarter of young adults believe AI has the potential to replace human romantic relationships, according to the Institute for Family Studies. Of the people most in favor of AI relationships, heavy porn users are at the top. We're already seeing how chatbots that were designed that weren't designed for this purpose are being used as romantic partners. Several AI companies have sprung up to meet the demand for AI partners. And on October 14th, OpenAI announced that ChatGPT is getting in on the game. Starting in December, CEO Sam Altman said in a post on X, "As part of our treat adult users like adults principle, we will allow even more like erotica for verified adults. But tech-based solutions that completely smooth out the necessary friction of living and growing through the natural course of a relationship are not a sustainable solution for society's romantic frustrations. So much of the benefits of partnership come from moments of disagreement and conflict resolution. That's when you learn the most about yourself and your partner. Most AI chatbots are made to be agreeable and cater to your every need, which isn't how typical romantic partnerships work. So many of us believed that technology could enrich our lives, but never thought it would take up so much space in our relationships. Arriving at our digisexual reality has been a slippery slope from app to bot that we never saw coming. Now that awareness of these trends is on the rise, will we consciously allow technology to continue to shape our relationships? And will the next wave of tech make us even more dependent on it for love?" Moving on to In the Loop by Andrew R. Chow, tech correspondent. In October, heart-wrenching photos of a 12-year-old girl driving her sick puppy to the vet went viral on social media. But upon closer examination, users noticed strange details. Her steering wheel was on the right side of the car, which also lacked a dashboard. The image, perhaps predictably, was another example of AI slop, artificial content designed for no reason other than maximum engagement on social media. An increasing amount of AI slop is now churning through social media thanks to the arrival of Sora 2, OpenAI's new text-to-video model. The tool, which quickly shot to the top of the App Store, allows users to describe a scene and then renders it within seconds. While OpenAI CEO Sam Altman hopes the videos will feel fun and new, critics see them as potential death knell for social media. What was supposed to be a revolutionary medium for maintaining friendships and relationships has now become a fake content generation machine, where it's impossible to tell what is and isn't real. The irony is that AI might end up saving human connection because they're making us so desperate for that real thing, says Kashyap Rajesh, a vice president at the youth-led organization ENCODE. Realistic AI-generated images and videos are a major goal for every major AI lab. AI leaders hope that users will be able to create music videos, movies, and advertisements quickly and cheaply, spurring a new age of creativity. Some also believe video models are the key to ushering in artificial general intelligence, or AGI, that understands physics perfectly and thus can move seamlessly through the world. In order to hone their models, these companies need users to create large amounts of content that can be used for training data. This year alone, Meta has released a dedicated AI video feed called Vibes, Google released Veo 3, and ByteDance released C-Dance. These apps can be viewed as part of a larger flywheel. Mainstream usage simultaneously improves the products. As a result, many users are now enjoying AI videos of talking gnomes or Tupac Shakur boxing the Pope. But Rajesh argues that realistic AI videos will threaten our shared understanding of reality and make it extremely cheap and easy to run disinformation and misinformation campaigns. While Sora videos come with watermarks signifying their provenance, tools have already been created to either add or remove them, sowing confusion. It kind of creates this low-level paranoia within people that kills the spontaneity and magic of social media to begin with, Rajesh says. Ben Coleman, the CEO of Reality Defender, conducted a security experiment and found that he was able to use Sora to forge AI impersonations of prominent people and then authenticate them as if they originated from the celebrities themselves. He also worries AI will exacerbate divisive content. The platforms are effectively marketplaces for attention, he says. It creates this infinitely more polarizing echo chamber of giving mass market consumers what they need to become more extreme in all things. Some people are growing so disenchanted they are renouncing their phones altogether. Earlier this year, educator Grant Besner co-organized a program in D.C. called Month on Offline, in which participants are encouraged to turn off their smartphones for a month and interrogate their relationships with the devices they have become addicted to. He says that Sora 2 and hyper-realistic video may be the breaking point where humans kind of reclaim some of their agency and say, you know what, this whole frictionless way of relating to information and to each other and to ourselves maybe isn't producing better outcomes. Moving on to Time Off, Family Matters by Stephanie Zakarik. A crop of fall movies search proverbial and literal attics to explore what makes a family unit tick. One of the most grimly funny poems of the past century is Philip Larkin's This Be the Verse, with its opening salvo about how our parents invariably mess us up. Larkin used a saltier word for mess, but you get the idea. Parents make us who we are, and if we have siblings, our parents' traits and legacies filter through the whole gang in various combinations. As Larkin wrote, they fill you with the faults they had and add some extra, just for you. All humans come from parents, people whose genetic stamp we carry whether we like it or not, and perhaps excluding cases where these same people did not raise us. Their faults inform us, if not, as Larkin claimed, fill us. In the world of film, there have probably been as many movies about families as there are love stories. We're obsessed with family stories for good reason, though not all of them need to be loaded with trauma. This fall movie season, you might say we're exploring the subtler angles of how individual family members connect or don't. A documentary is in which a now famous son reflects on the lives of his famous parents. A triptych exploring slightly wacky parent-child relationships from a filmmaker who has specialized in vibrant off-kilter comedies since the 1980s and from a leading Danish-Norwegian filmmaker, a delicate but potent picture that looks at the damage an absentee parent can wreak, though reconnection and reconciliation are always possible, even if only in baby steps. Maybe familial ties, in a world that most days seems to have gone horribly wrong, where each whipsaw news cycle brings another story about humans inflicting cruelty on one another, are more important than ever. These films explore those bonds without ever resorting to bromides or mawkishness. Every family is flawed, unpredictable, aggravating in its own way, and still, they're often the thing that gets us through. Going through decades' worth of family possessions after the death of a parent is always a time for reflection, as well as the dumpster. Stuff tells a story, and actor, director, and producer Ben Stiller took the opportunity to make a documentary about his late parents. The ecstatically brilliant husband and wife comedy duo Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira, as he was cleaning out the New York City apartment where he and his sister Amy were raised. Jerry had a penchant for tape recording everything, from adorable things his kids said to arguments with Ann. There were also piles of paper and documents, including love letters Jerry had written to Ann when they were struggling young performers, separated for months at a time. Romance is how families get started, after all. Ben and Amy Stiller went through it all to make Stiller and Mira, Nothing is Lost, streaming on Apple TV+. Reflecting on how their famous parents, rather than shielding their kids from the limelight, allowed them to step right into it. A clip of young Ben and Amy unskillfully sawing away at a violin duet on The Mike Douglas Show, as their parents watch, beaming, gives you a sense of the unfiltered pride Jerry and Ann took in their kids. But Jerry and Ann also had work that took them away from home for long stretches, and in later life they expressed regret over that. Stiller acknowledges that he now sees how he repeated the pattern with his own kids. Like his father, he felt the need to hustle to keep his career and family afloat. Part of growing up is seeing your parents as real people with faults, but that recognition never happens in a flash, and it deepens with time. That's what Stiller reckons with here. Not just that his parents did the best they could, but that who they were shaped him and his sister in granular ways that defy explanation, wobbly violin playing notwithstanding. Treasured indie filmmaker Jim Jarmusch has also reached an age when he's ready to examine the warped world of parent-child as well as sibling bonds. In Father, Mother, Sister, Brother, opening December 24th, he presents vignettes of three not-quite-average families. In one, a twin brother and sister, separated only by geography, India Moore and Lucas Sabat, connect in Paris to reminisce about their recently deceased parents who raised them there. They, too, need to go through the stuff, a part of grieving that involves an often jarring kind of tactile reckoning. In another, Charlotte Rampling plays a chilly, wound-tight matriarch and successful novelist who welcomes her two daughters, pink-haired free spirit Vicky Cripes and Kate Blanchett, as the prim, dutiful, but seemingly less favored child to her tidy Dublin home for a once-a-year Sunday afternoon tea. Though the girls call their mother Mummy, you can hardly imagine her changing a messy diaper or wiping a stray driblet of drool. Yet you recognize that the halting decorum with which they communicate is its own kind of affection, a language worked out across decades. But the funniest and sweetest of Jarmusch's three stories is the one in which siblings Adam Driver and Mayim Bialik pay a rare visit to their father, whom they've always found mysterious. They're not sure what he ever did for a living. They worry that now, as a senior citizen, he's hanging by a slender financial thread. When they arrive at Dad's remote shambles of a house, they make note of the scrubby yard and the beat-up truck parked there. But he greets them with crusty bonhomie. It doesn't hurt that he's played by the great singer, songwriter, and actor Tom Waits. He's happy to see them. He gratefully accepts the basket of special treats, spaghetti sauce, a bottle of bourbon his son has brought. The three of them sit through their visit rather awkwardly. Dad has nothing but tea to offer his kids, and they make a joke, one that recurs in the movie, of wondering out loud whether it's bad luck to toast with it. Finally, the kids slink away, happy to be free of this weird glimpse into their aged father's life. But Waits' dad is a man with a secret, a harmless but hilarious one. Jarmusch is getting at something elusive here. We may think we're the center of our parents' world, but once we leave the nest, their lives become their own once again. Who knows what they're really getting up to? Yet the most radiant of these films is Joachim Trier's Sentimental Value, opening on November 7th, in which a long-absent father, Stellan Skarsgård's Gustav, an esteemed but aging filmmaker, returns to his family home in Oslo to reconnect with his two grown daughters, Renate Rensevi's Nora, a neurotic but respected stage actress, and Inga Isbat's daughter Lilias's Agnes, a mother and historian. Nora and Agnes's mother has just died, another instance in which all the cupboards and closets must be gone through, with the sisters left to decide who will take which glass vase or oft-used dish. Gustav, who left the family abruptly when his children were little, has returned not so much to mourn his estranged wife as to interest Nora in playing a movie role he's written for her. Nora meets with him in a cafe. He outlines his request almost plaintively. She listens with the guarded indifference before rejecting him outright. Although Agnes, having married and born a child of her own, appears to have been more successful in moving past Gustav's abandonment, Nora has never forgiven him. She has mostly hidden her suffering in often damaging ways. Only Agnes, the younger of the two sisters, knows the extent of it. Gustav finds a replacement actress, an American. She's played with winsome gravitas by Elle Fanning, and moves forward with his project, but not really. This small family trio is temporarily frozen in place. Gustav can't make peace with the daughter he's hurt so gravely. Worse yet, he can't even make art about his desire to do so. Agnes, grounded and generous, plays the go-between, but even she finds that role wearying. And Nora simply spirals. Gustav's reappearance has forced a reckoning she's not ready for. Rensvi, the star of Trier's 2021 breakthrough hit The Worst Person in the World, shines here. She's a firecracker that has lost its pop, left only to sputter and smoke. But Lilias, as Agnes, is the movie's stealth weapon, a performer so serenely poetic that you might find yourself leaning toward the screen to catch every nuance. In a late screen, she comes to the rescue as Nora finds herself in crisis, only to remind her sister that any strength she has is thanks to Nora's care and affection all through their childhood. When parents drop the ball, siblings often have a way of taking care of one another, carving a path into the future together. Tenderness is the new punk, Trier said in May when he premiered Sentimental Value at the Cannes Film Festival, coining what would become the signature phrase of 2025. I need to believe that we can see the other, he continued, that there is a sense of reconciliation. Polarization, anger, and machismo aren't the way forward. Sentimental Value is a drama about one family, but it could also be a message in a bottle for the greater world. Larkin, a proto-punk, poked fun at the way humans, just by procreating, pass their worst traits to their children and beyond through infinity. Trier has much more hope, and his tender punk manifesto echoes something the English clergyman and his historian Thomas Fuller said more than three centuries ago. Charity begins at home, but it shouldn't end there. Moving on to Time Off Movies, a review. A New Wave Origin Story and an Act of Love by Stephanie Zakarik. Some days it seems we live in a horrid world where most humans couldn't give a fig about art. How many people in that world are going to care about a 65-year-old black and white movie, one that, for anyone who doesn't speak French, requires the reading of subtitles? Yet, here comes Richard Linklater's sensational Nouvelle Vague, an agile, witty, elegant picture about the making of Jean-Luc Godard's canon shot of a debut, 1960's A Bout de Souffle, known to English speakers as Breathless. Breathless is a movie that possibly only film lovers and bona fide old people care about. What current-day filmmaker would choose it as a subject? Only someone who cares. Nouvelle Vague is the ultimate inside baseball making of movie. But even more than that, it's a picture that stands strong on the side of art, of history, of working to solve the puzzle of things that maybe at first you don't fully understand. It's both a shout of joy and a call to arms. It's all about the bold, muscular act of giving a damn. Godard was just 29 when he made Breathless, in which Jean-Paul Belmondo's sexy, raffish Michel Picard steals a car, shoots a cop, and is ultimately betrayed by his American wannabe journalist girlfriend, Jean Seberg's gamine femme fatale, Patricia Franchini. Nouvelle Vague tells the story of how the enigmatically charming yet sort of a jerk Godard, played marvelously by Guillaume Marbeck, wheedled his way into making Breathless, shot in just 23 days, guerrilla style, largely on the streets of Paris. First, he must assemble a cast. He persuades his friend, Belmondo, Aubrey Dillon, to play Michel, making his pitch at the boxing gym where the amiable, loose-limbed actor is working out. Can he get Jean Seberg, Zoe Deutsch, already a star, to play Patricia? She agrees only reluctantly, and later, aggravated by Godard's idiosyncrasies, she'll threaten to quit. He hires a clever, good-natured cinematographer, the gentle giant Raoul Coutard, Mathieu Penchinon. There's a persnickety script girl, Susan Fay, Pauline Bell, who tries to tell her boss Godard that for continuity's sake he can't remove a cup from a table on the set. Reality is not continuity, he says, just one of the many bossy, spontaneous, maddeningly delightful pronouncements he makes as he and his friends, all under 30, most with no idea what they're doing, launch into the adventure of making a moving picture. Deutsch, with his ragamuffin chic blonde pixie cut, is marvelous Seberg, capturing her real-life counterpart's dang-flat, Midwestern-accented French. And as Belmondo, Dolan gives a performance of spectacular physicality, whether he's scrambling in his pocket for chicken feed to buy a small cafe meal, or his character having just been shot, staggering and stumbling down a Paris street in a half-tragic, half-funny promenade with Godard and his camera crew trailing behind. Marbeck, peering through dark glasses, shaking his pipe as he spins out his sometimes puzzling aphorisms, captures the impish magnetism of the young Godard. You want to slug him. You also adore him. Nouvelle Vague is film as invitation, the best kind. If you don't know Breathless, what are you waiting for? And if you do know it, Nouvelle Vague will make you see it anew. Is there a difference between loving a movie and being in love with one? Maybe the distinction is subtle, but when a movie makes you want to weep with joy, you know something is happening. There's no resisting the gangster of love. Moving on to review. Descending into Madness brilliantly. In an early scene in Lynn Ramsey's brutal, beautiful Die My Love, we see Jennifer Lawrence crawling through a sunny, grassy field on all fours, low to the ground like a sultry panther, as we hear a baby crying somewhere nearby. It turns out he's been parked safely on a porch. We don't know what Lawrence's precise feral belly crawl means. Did I mention that she's clutching a kitchen knife? Except somewhere in our gut we do know the animal thing that drives us to pair up, to have sex, to fall in love, is the precursor to the adored pink before crying on the porch. The living, wailing, needy thing you'd do anything for. Die My Love, in theaters November 7th, is about something no one wants to talk about, not just postpartum depression, but full-on madness for which there's no cure, not even temporary relief. In the real world, it would be diagnosed as psychosis, but Ramsey's film, adapted from Arianna Harwit's slender scalpel of a novel, isn't about symptoms, causes, or treatments. It's about pure feeling, highs and lows that ought to balance one another, but somehow don't. This is also the most complex, unsettling, and bleakly funny performance Lawrence, a fine, persuasive, charming actor since the beginning, has given. Die My Love follows a young couple, Grace, Lawrence, and Jackson, Robert Pattinson, as their relationship disintegrates post-baby. Grace rails at her partner for everything he can't give her, even as he can't begin to fathom what she wants or needs. Grace is angry, but she hasn't turned against her baby. In fact, the exact opposite. She's attuned to his cries as if they were issuing from her own throat. But she breastfeeds him with a blank look in her eyes. He's draining her dry, though her emptiness isn't his fault, and she knows it. Sometimes Grace is capable of manic pleasure. We see her alone in her lonely house with its ditzy floral wallpaper, dancing like a teenager to Tony Basil's Mickey. But mostly she fills her days with a kind of rattling, desperate emptiness. And though both Jackson and his cluelessly sympathetic mother, played by Sissy Spacek, try to help, they just can't reach her. All of this must make Die My Love sound like torture, the sort of cinema of unpleasantness you'd do well to run a mile from. But Scottish filmmaker Ramsey, whose last film was 2017's striking You Were Never Really Here, never gives us the simple, predictable thing. Die My Love is a kind of black comedy, both jagged and graceful. It's gorgeous to look at, a warped back-to-the-land reverie, complete with wildflower-dotted fields and happily buzzing bees. That also feels like a kind of cosmic hell, and it works because it invites us to walk with Grace rather than judge or, God forbid, diagnose her. Lawrence has had children herself, and her body shows it. She's no movie star stick figure. She has a dreamy earthiness, like a Rembrandt nude. Her face is round and plaintive. She's vulnerable looking, like a baby Ellen Barkin. And as Grace, she goes not just to the edge, but beyond it. This is the kind of performance people call fearless, for lack of a better word. I'm sure there is a better word, but who knows what it is. What Lawrence does here is so delicately textured, even within its bold expressiveness, that it leaves you scrambling for adjectives. It's the kind of performance you go to the movies for, one that connects so sympathetically with the idea of human suffering that it scares you a little. Yet, weirdly, by the end, Die My Love makes you feel more exhilarated than drained. At its heart, it's classic l'amour fou, but for the one not two, the ultimate expression of what it means to be dancing with yourself. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Stacey Stamus with Time Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the Audio Reading Service at the Allen County Public Library.